Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with Dr. Paul Dobransky on a unique visual system he developed to understand and utilize healthy human boundaries. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one in a developing story that is raising concerns over a potential nuclear cover-up by the EPA. Alarming amounts of radiation were reported near the border of Indiana and Michigan and later censored by the EPA online Geiger tool. The readings, which were captured in a screenshot, measured as high as 7.139 counts per minute. This is particularly startling as the normal radiation levels are generally between 5 and 6 CPM. Sources say that a Department of Homeland Security hazmat team has now been dispatched after years of inactivity. The number of community reports have come in on the subject. In fact, with readers of community boards and concerned citizens offering up some interesting and intriguing information regarding the potential radiation cover-up. One Reddit reader, an eyewitness who reportedly attends a nearby university, shared some concerning information which quickly rose to the top and was later confirmed by accompanying comments. According to the user, a large fleet of hazmat team members and response trucks funded by the Homeland Security have been dispatched after years of inactivity. The comment states, "I work at a large public university next to a small research reactor that's located near the back of the campus. There's normally a large fleet of hazmat response trucks and trailers parked in the nearby lot. Most of them are NIMS, early response vehicles funded by the Homeland Security. Haven't seen them move since I started working a few years ago. Tonight, they're all gone." The Digital Journal submission, however, was promptly edited and much of the shocking detail in the original post was wiped away. They quickly added an edit stating that the measurements must be false due to the fact that they were so high. Comments quickly cited the changes to be inaccurate and bizarre. Something to pay attention to. Here's another story, and it's a topic we've covered a lot on the show, and that's smart meters. Government plans to install smart meters in our homes, and this will leave us open to cyber attack. Now remember, we're going to go a little deeper into Agenda 21, and it's not a partisan issue, although the Tea Party and the right-wing talk show hosts talk about this. It's not right or left, Democrat, Republican, it's everyone that's concerned, and it's disguised as an environmental issue. That's what causes the polarity. When there's that polarity and people are fighting each other, it makes it very easy to usher this in. Intelligence chiefs have warned that plans to install smart energy meters in every house will leave families vulnerable to terrorist attacks. According to the government's listening agency, GCHQ, the plans will create a strategic vulnerability, giving foreign computer hackers the opportunity to target individual homes, municipal buildings, and even whole districts. Described by security experts as the modern-day equivalent of a nuclear strike, hackers would be able to switch off meters from overseas, cutting off targets from the national grid. Intrusion? Smart meters could be installed in every property that could lead to cyber attack. Privacy campaigners are already seeking to block the plans on the grounds that the meters will create a spy in every home. The meters will collect details about how people use electricity and gas, allowing snoopers to, for example, scrutinize what time someone goes to bed, washes, or uses their computer. The information will be beamed to a central database held by a utility firm, making it a tempting target for hackers. I want to add one thing. Remember how utilities, such as telecommunication companies, give up your data. They'll give it away to corporations and other third-party groups. Are you going to allow utility companies to put smart meters in your building, in your apartment? The people who refuse the smart meters, their houses or buildings are staked out, and when they're not around, that's when these people come in, trespass, come into the backyard, rip out the old meter, and install a new one. Read those stories. It gives you an idea of what's happening around us. A spokesman for the DOE, Department for Energy, said the rollout of meters will help put people in control of their energy use and eliminate the cause of a huge number of complaints and inaccurate bills. Once again, it's in the disguise of we're only trying to help you. it's more convenient, safe. Here, I'll just a couple comments here. I have a gas meter, an electricity meter, and a water meter in my house. Now we're told we're going to have a smart meter. Whatever next? A meter to say how much air I've consumed? But why stop there? Why not fix CCTV in all our homes, and they can tax us until the cows come home? Agenda 21. It's not just in the United States. It's all over the planet. And remember that conference coming up in Rio, June 22nd, Rio Plus 20. Here's a story from on the Intel Hub by James Britpod. Rockefeller Foundation predicts 13,000 dead at London 2012 Olympics. A 2010 Rockefeller Foundation document entitled Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development outlines a scenario which results in the death of 13,000 during the 2012 Olympics. The first prediction begins in 2012 when the, quote, pandemic the world had been anticipating for years finally hits, claiming 8 million lives. Due to this pandemic, the Rockefeller Foundation outlines how the public will welcome a more authoritative government and a tighter control across all aspects of life, including biometric IDs for all citizens. The 2012 London Olympics bombing. In the document, the Rockefeller Foundation predicts that the decade of 2010-2020 will be named the Doom Decade because of a wave of terrorist attacks, natural disasters, as well as civil uprisings and financial collapses. Just as desired by globalists for more than 100 years, the developed world begins to fall back into feudalism, with the gap between the rich and poor growing to levels not seen for hundreds of years as the middle class becomes extinct. The rich moving into fortress-like compounds, whereas the poor are forced to move into ghettos. By 2030, the document portrays the, quote, developed and developed nations to no longer be relevant or distinguishable. Agenda 21. The report also outlines several environmental scenarios stemming from climate change, which include a new worldwide economic system based on green infrastructure by 2018. The foundation describes how the resulting collapse of society requires an exodus out of rural areas and into urban environments for survivability, a bizarre take on reality where those living in urban environments are far more restricted in being self-sufficient than those in rural areas who have the ability to more easily grow their food. Another mirror to Agenda 21 is the document's prediction that only the very rich will have the ability to travel as prices skyrocket and the restrictions in the name of security reach such high levels that the poor simply can't travel from their communities. Conclusion? These predictive papers are a window into the think tanks who help shape world events. Where the documents are always portrayed as simple predictions, it's important to realize that many such papers have been eerily accurate in the past. One thing to mention about this is I'm connecting with a variety of people who are doing their own research. Some people out in Long Island, connected with Long Island Skywatch, had done a little bit of research into a conference called Water Worries. The group that underwrote this Water Worries conference is connected to a corporation that develops spray nozzles to fit onto aircraft. It's a company that has connections to climate technology, atomizing material through a variety of very sophisticated looking fixtures that mount onto aircraft. Is that a smoking gun? Connecting Agenda 21 with geoengineering? Maybe. Is geoengineering under the umbrella of Agenda 21? Many people think so.
Dr. Korotkov's work in scientifically measuring the effects of human intention on universally sensitive elements such as water will help support some of the ideas and systems we'll talk about in the show. We're made up of around 75% water, and according to Dr. Korotkov, any intention or affirmation, negative or positive, will have profound effects on ourselves and others, and those effects are quantifiable, scientifically measurable, he says. Last month, we briefly spoke about the importance of boundaries with Stuart Wilde, and how his book, Silent Power, is a stepping stone to better boundaries. In the context of holding onto your power, the boundary is not an impervious membrane. It's got to be semi-permeable, like any living cell. There's a give and take. But how does it work? This realm is essentially invisible. What types of energy exchanges are going on with or without your awareness? Only a handful of people have researched and written in depth about the mechanism of healthy boundaries. Our guest, Dr. Paul Dobransky, has put together a powerful visual system to understand and begin to utilize a healthy human boundary. He says, your identity in life depends on learning about boundaries. It's connected to learning how to be free from stress, how to command respect, blame unhealthy boundaries for missed opportunities, job or relation failure, things like these. Dr. Paul, as many know him as, is a psychiatrist, an author, a speaker, and runs several websites. He's conducted many seminars on dating and relationships with men and women. His system called MindOS is a starting point for most of his clients, and it covers a lot of material, but today we focus in on what is a boundary, why is it important, and we'll try to put that into context of the past shows. Dr. Paul Dobransky joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, what does it mean to have holes in your boundary, and what creates the holes?
Well, I think most people can associate with the idea of, say, a national border. And I think that's a really good metaphor, one of many metaphors for explaining what boundaries are. But it's like having your own national border of your own country, and you're the only citizen. So just like in parts of Montana or, you know, parts of Arizona or Texas, there might be some little weaknesses down there where, you know, animals can get through. And it's the same with us. So having holes in your boundary is like having some gaps in your own national border, and all the things that can happen nationally could happen to you personally.
That's a really good way to understand it and visualize it, the microcosm and macrocosm mm-hmm. element here. You went a step further, of course. You had to, because you did all of this work. But you then talked about the economics of sharing information within the boundary, and you can't do that with a hole in the boundary. How do you develop a door or another system?
Sure. You know, one of the ways of thinking about it is, you know, developmentally, we all have to go from immature to mature, if we can, over our lifespan. And we want to grow more and more mature character. But bumping into other people and their tastes and preferences and needs is essential for us to grow boundaries in the first place. A good film example of this is, you remember Tom Hanks in Castaway?
Yes.
How he's stuck on that island, and he eventually is just going insane, and he has this volleyball that he calls Wilson, and he paints a face on it in blood, and he's got to have some other to interact with to know that he still exists. Well, we need others to interact with to know where boundaries even fall, right? So as we go through life, our parents first hopefully teach us something about that. And then other kids at school and teachers, coaches. And as we're growing up, we bump into more and more kinds of people and varieties of people. I think it's one of the great reasons that kids ought to travel. Kids ought to have study abroad experiences, for example, in college, so they can experience all different cultures, all different lifestyles, and bump into lots of types of people, all of whom have their tastes and preferences and needs.
When your boundaries are unhealthy, what are some of the things that could happen?
Well, some of the ways, other ways of thinking about boundaries are that it operates as a shield. If you thought of medieval times, how somebody could get into a fight, he'd have a sword and a shield. And if you use your sword, that burns all your energy up. But if you just put up a shield, you block other people's attacks. So our boundary is a shield against stress, and stress is just negative emotional energy. It's simultaneously, though, like a tank, like a tank of our fuel. And one of the ways of thinking of our emotional fuel is that's self-esteem. There are two varieties of self-esteem that I talk about. So it's both a shield and a tank. It's a container.
I'm glad you brought up the defending yourself part, because on this show we often talk about energy vampires and, mm-hmm. and things like that. And we tried to understand what's going on psychologically with past guest Dr. Joe Slate and others, even Matthew Deleuze. What's going on with people who you're near, they would drain your energy and mm-hmm. things like that. Is there a scientific explanation for this?
Sure. In fact, I had a mentor in psychiatry in medical school, kind of turned me on to doing psychiatry as a specialty, and he was an anthropologic psychiatrist. I thought it was one of the most unusual things I had ever heard of, that he spent a lot of his life's work studying vampire and zombie myths in world cultures. And at first glance, that sounds kind of like Abraham Lincoln vampire hunter or something, you know, very out there. But it's legitimate science, a legitimate academic endeavor for him. What he determined is that vampire and zombie myths exist in all world cultures, even if they have no connection to other cultures throughout all history, because they evolve as a way of teaching a society about what pathologic narcissism is. And that's really what vampires mean symbolically, pathologic narcissism.
You're really you're taking the fun out of the vampire mythology. But I kind of understand what you're saying. It's a condition where just something's not right. And you had pointed out earlier that it's a young person in an adult's body.
Let's make it fun and scary again then. It's very, very real. I mean, if you talk to people in the process of divorcing, that's very real and very scary and very painful. And blood is symbolic of a kind of life energy. It's life force. So this concept of a vampire, an emotional vampire, or a pathologic narcissist, to psychiatrists, that's how we talk about this. It's somebody who drains your emotional energy, which is very real, very scary. You're exhausted being around this kind of person. They literally do drain you, even though it's invisible and it's not blood. It is your life force. It's your energy. It's your self-esteem. Your self-esteem is being sucked away for real mm-hmm. by a person. Mm-hmm. So it's even scarier than a horror movie. It's real.
Right, where you could at least see the blood and try to stop the bleeding. You
right.
can't even see it.
Right.
But if you know your work and you understand the boundaries maybe in your material, you could feel it happening. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very subjective thing. You know, if you don't notice what's happening and one day you get a wake-up call, you're in a relationship that you didn't even realize that you've lost your sense of self. It's become codependent. Or you're in a toxic workplace where the boss is a bully and you came in all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed on your first day of work. And then a year later, you're this sullen, depressed, depressing person. You're like, oh my God, what happened to me? Well, you've been a victim of a pathologic narcissist.
That's fascinating.
An emotional vampire.
That's amazing.
Bullying.
It's bullying.
Bullying is a big, big topic, and it's not new. It's been around forever, and it's kind of what pathologic narcissists do. Vampires, they're bullies.
The opposite of that, when you're around somebody who makes you feel good, what's going on there in terms of the boundary dynamic?
Well, being around, it's almost like a definition of friendship. You know, my second book for women was about women's friendships with each other. And as I was trying to lay out, you know, my personal definition based in science of what that would look like, it has four variables. And then simultaneously, I was looking for, you know, are there any ancient philosophers that talked about friendship? And I actually could only find one, Aristotle. I forget what exactly his terms were, but they were so similar. Friendship is mutual, shared, consistent mutual shared positive emotion. Consistent meaning what you see is what you get. It's always going to be that way. Most of the time, it's going to be that way. Person keeps their word. They say they're going to show up to help you move. They show up to help you move. It's mutual, meaning it's a two-way street. It's win-win. It's not always you leaning on that, on them, and them always leaning on you. It's both of you doing that 50-50. It's shared, meaning if your friend that you just met moves across country, well, what are you going to do together? You have to do things together for a friendship to exist. And then the most important terminology of all is positive emotion. You can't have a friendship based just on complaining or negativity and this sort of thing. It'll dissolve eventually. So that's one example of, you know, being around a positive person who is your equal, your peer. We call that a friend. And what we share with each other is love or friendship. They're the same thing. It's shared positive emotion.
Thanks for describing that. I appreciate that. You go into detail about the currencies of the four currencies, mm-hmm. and how those are important in the exchange in a relationship or a friendship or an intimate or business or things like that.
Sure.
Those types of relationships. But if that's not there, you get static, or if you're in a intimate relationship and the boundaries have dissolved and you're sharing all these things and there's a breakup, mm-hmm. what happens there?
Well, the natural course of, say, a codependent relationship where one or both people are kind of narcissistic.
Codependent, right? That's what it's called.
Codependence, what the natural course is, there's mutual bullying, so to speak, that's going on. The boundary between the two people breaks down, and it can create an illusion that feels, at first, really, really good. And we call that intimacy. I mean, when we know somebody intimately, it means we have full access to everything they are, how they feel. We have shared feelings, shared ideas. We feel bonded to each other, and it feels great. But if a couple or two friends or business partners, whoever it is, can't sometimes put up a boundary again and close the door on each other on areas they disagree with each other on, agree to disagree,
right.
then eventually one or the other person in this permanent intimacy starts kind of bullying the other, and then the best one wins. They start acquiring all the resources in the relationship. It becomes all about them, always benefiting them, and not the other person, until finally the one that acquires all the resources, the relationship, says, oh, wow, I feel full. Thank you. See you later. We're going to part ways. And then there's a winner and a loser. And somebody goes off with less than what they had before.
And the material in that boundary, that's more than just self-esteem.
It's self-esteem. It's your time. It may be your money. It's your energy, your passion, your spirit, your humor, your information, your education, all these parts to you. There's an invisible economy. You were talking about, you know, what are the currencies of this silent interpersonal economy that goes on between people? Well, both lawyers and judges will describe what they call a person legally. A person is an entity with cognitive, emotional, and volitional capacity. And all that means is somebody has intellectual ability and data. We're exchanging data right now, so that's one currency, learning. Second is emotion or happiness. A third is freedom, decision-making capacity. That's volition, okay? So I borrowed from, you know, the legal terminology of what a person is, cognitive, emotional, and volitional capacity.
I wonder where you got that. It's time-tested
mm-hmm.
in court, and these are the currencies of and dynamics of being in a relationship. Was love in this as well?
Yeah, love is a synonym for happiness or self-esteem. They're all positive emotional energy. Love, friendship, happiness, self-esteem. They're the same thing.
You had also talked about things like karma and how that's scientifically measurable.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give us a brief understanding of that?
Yeah, you remember the film A Beautiful Mind? About John Nash and the Nash equilibrium from game theory and economics. I think some of his work is basically a mathematical proof of karma. That's what he did. That's why he got a Nobel Prize. It's a mathematical proof of karma. At first, if you are a shark and take advantage of people and bully people and you're a narcissist, you're a vampire, you'll overpower people quickly and you'll win in the short term. You're kind of a con artist kind of person. You'll win in the short term, but eventually society will catch on to you punish you, and then you're done. The opposite of that is somebody who's kind of a milquetoast, somebody that's easily taken advantage of. They lose right away. You know, you give your lunch money away to other people, to bullies. But the proper way to navigate this kind of interaction is halfway between the two. Have a boundary where every interaction with other people ought to be fair, generally, and equitable, and win-win. So the Nash equilibrium, John Nash, talked about win-win versus win-lose interactions, and only win-win interactions are going to be durable as a connection between people.
What we're talking about here may seem obvious to some people who naturally understand it, but not everyone has these structures and systems running unconsciously. Some people have to work on this.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you take that win-lose all the time?
Well, then you are being a dependent person. You're the kind of person that your way of making your way in life is going to be your strategy at trying to win the lotto. You're waiting for magic to happen to save you in life. You're looking for a parent, essentially. And so you've got a lot of growing to do, you know, if you're in that state. Now, at the same time, a lot of people get a lot of gratification feeling like a parent to people. If they're kind of a caretaking type of person, there's a lot of gratification they get out of the mothering role to others. It makes them feel great. But in the end, you know, if everybody's not following the golden rule, then it doesn't work so well. Everybody has to follow the golden rule for it to work.
I gotcha. Okay. And you're talking about spoiling your children. Is that what the mothering instinct? Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that when a person does a lot of parentalism toward others, there's a lot of personal gratification they can get out of that. It's a high that they get.
I understand.
But it needs to not be their only way of feeling good about who they are.
Do you come across that scenario a lot in your work in treating patients?
Sure. People that, you know, overly caretake others and enable others and are codependent. Oh, yeah. Sure. A lot.
We're coming to the break here, and we want to open the phone lines. If you have any comments or questions for Dr. Paul Dobrensky, give us a call at 212-209-2900, and we'll be right back after this break.
Great God, my
You're listening to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Our guest is Dr. Paul Dobransky, and we've opened the phone lines to take your calls if you have a question or comment of the past material that we've been discussing, and that is really learning how to take control of that invisible realm, the boundary issue, and how that really is a link to almost everything around us. We're going to go to the first call, I think. Yep. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hi, caller.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi. I love you, Jeff. Your show is magnificent.
Thank you very much. Do you have a question?
Yes. I wanted to ask your guest, how do you recover from core traumatization and extreme traumatization in a 15-year-old child?
Wow. Well, it's a long answer. A therapist probably has some role in there. There are a lot
That's
of...
That's not working at all.
Well...
My child's getting sicker, and we're separated.
Oh, well, I will say this, that mental health systems these days are designed to be teams. You know, it's usually not just one person who's responsible for getting somebody better, who has a complicated... traumatic history like that. There's often an MD doctor who may or may not prescribe something where it's appropriate. There may be a psychologist or social worker who does therapy. And then there's the family system. So everybody's involved. We're all on one team in mental health. And that's there's a lot of power in that, in having a team.
Well, my child's on she's on toxic medication for almost 4 years, and it has totally changed her personality, and it's also causing toxicity to her brain. And I'm very concerned about that because I only believe in orphan molecular psychiatry.
Okay.
And they won't allow me, I don't have any rights to help her, and I'm terrified because I want her back, and there's no way that I can get her because it was a court case and things are not working out, you know, and she's getting sicker and I'm getting sicker, and we've been separated for a very, very long time, and she's my only child.
It sounds like you need answers, and that probably involves consulting with as many people as you can, right, to get as much as advice as you can about what your options are. Can't really speak to the medicines, but there are more and more advanced therapies that get developed all the time for trauma. We get better and better at treating trauma these days. There's a lot of hope where decades and decades ago there wasn't as much hope about getting people better from trauma psychologically.
Thank you very much for that call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Quick comment about your current events and then a question or two for Paul. That's interesting about the Olympics. I predicted nothing would happen until after that, but you're saying it's going to happen actually, the person you were reading is going to happen at the Olympics.
Right, based on a Rockefeller white paper, it was predictive. It's interesting that that's what they're thinking about. What's your question for Dr. Paul?
Paul, what do you think of a good place to start with a lot of the things you mentioned to recover from or explore is Al-Anon? Because I've done some of that. A friend of mine turned me on to it. And
Al-Anon?
Yeah. 12 steps.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of good in those programs. You know, the common things that they teach us in medical school and psychiatry training about 12-step programs is it used to be thought that that's the only thing that can truly fix or manage addiction, for example. And I know codependence is a big issue there, but there's something very special about 12-step programs. If you recall the thing they call the Serenity Prayer, right?
Yeah.
You've heard of that? Grant me the serenity to A, accept the things I cannot change. That's what's outside your boundary. The courage to B, change the things I can.
Right.
That's what's inside your boundary. And then when they say, and grant me the wisdom to know the difference, that is the boundary.
Right.
So I think what's so great about 12-step programs, for one, is they teach boundaries in a very easy, clear-cut way.
Yeah.
Through that serenity prayer.
Well, I grew up in a boundaryless family, so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that's tough. It's like, you know, being in the wild. It's like being in the jungle. Dealing with wildlife, you know.
Well, I believe the work you're doing. Well, when I went to the 12 steps and started seeing this for the first time and hearing this, and for Jeff to put this on, I really think we've had many teachers, and there'd be a lot more teachers or spiritual teachers. But I think this is what'll really make a difference if people really address these issues for themselves. One, they could see when they're being bamboozled.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they can really come to peace and then be kinder people to one another and not get sucked into all the reaction. My last question. A lot of things you described, how these narcissistic people can do this, can this be done to, like, say, on a mass scale to, like, a whole country?
Select
few, can they do this to the United States?
Oh, well.
And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, Jeff. Sure. Thank you. Wow, that's profound. The things he was just saying. I mean, it's an invitation for me to get on my soapbox. I think boundaries are conceivably a cure for all war. The lack of them is the cause of all war. The boundaries are the problem with bullying. That's why bullying has always been so invisible. Bullying can happen from the unexpected sources. You know, we usually think of the old bullying the young, or employers bullying employees, or men bullying women. Well, it happens all around, mm-hmm. and from any direction. An employee can bully a boss.
It reverses.
It's a lack of boundaries. It's abusing somebody, busting through somebody else's boundary against their will. That's bullying. It's what bullying is. And I think what's so powerful about showing boundaries as a diagram, as a circle. And poor boundaries have holes in them. It's like having gaps in your national border. But when your boundary is solid, it is a solid shield. It's a solid tank to contain your resources. And what's in it is sacrosanct. What's in it belongs to you and only you. In fact, Declaration of Independence, when they talk about, we hold these rights to be inalienable or unalienable, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, life is measured in events, data points. Liberty is freedom to make choices, and pursuit of happiness. Happiness is positive emotion. In what makes something unalienable is that there is a boundary. So in a sense, Rousseau and the founding fathers, the philosophers from that time, had a sense of what a boundary is and that it pre-exists everything we've developed. It's inherent in who we are. That we all have a boundary, this invisible circle around us.
I noticed you were talking about Robert Bly having the handle to the door on the inside of the boundary. So when you're opening it, you're in control of it. Of that door. And so no one can come up to you and start to siphon off anything.
Unless you are traumatized. And I mean, what trauma is in terms of boundaries is that you always have the right to say no to a proposal from someone else, some deal proposed to you. You can say no, thank you. But when somebody won't take no for an answer, they have either just done something criminal or unethical or abusive or traumatic toward you. They've invaded your boundary without your permission.
Our guest is Dr. Paul Dobransky. We're talking about boundaries. And Dr. Paul, you mentioned that people respect you more when you say no.
Yes.
Yeah, we got some calls on the line. We're going to go to another one. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good evening, Jeff. How you doing?
Hey, is this Ed?
Yeah, it's Ed. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good to hear from you again. I'm all right. And good evening, doctor.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good.
I had a question, it's in a comment, basically. I worked for an individual, like you talked about, several years ago, who was basically, for want of a better word, an energy vampire. I mean, when this guy walked into the room, he just sucked the air right out of the room. And whatever you tried to do, it seems like he drew power by belittling you.
Right.
And the most liberating thing I ever did, I managed to get another job.
Oh, yeah.
I gave him 2 weeks' notice, and he offered me more money to stay and work. And I told him, you don't have enough money to feed me. You know,
that's
and
great.
I never felt that good again in my life.
Yes.
Yes. What I'm saying is that as far as boundaries are concerned, I think because I had to work for this individual for such an extended period of time because I needed a place to live, basically, and he was my only source of income, his business, I picked up some of his traits, I think, unconsciously. Because now I'm doing some of the same things. I find myself doing some of the same things that he was doing as life goes on. And I just, you know, asserting your boundaries. How can you assert your boundaries without being offensive? I've been told I'm a little aggressive. I'm a little overbearing. How can you assert your boundaries without, you know, I don't feel threatened, but it's just...
Mm-hmm.
Well, coming up, I had to establish myself in my family. I come from a rough background.
Sure.
Without getting too much detail. And how do you learn? I mean, what's some techniques that you could give me just to tone it down, you know?
Sure,
You know, instead of over.
Well, you don't have to beat other people over the head with your boundary. You know, you can be subtle with it. You can use silence as a boundary. You can use non-response to people who are provocative. You don't have to talk to them. You can use physical distance. You know.
I got a problem with that silence thing. I got a problem with that. I got a problem with that.
With silence, yeah. Hold your tongue. Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, it's good politics. You know, it's a positive version. You know, a lot of times we think of politics as it's this negative thing, but it's a high character thing to be a diplomatic person who can get along with a lot of different people. And boundaries are crucial for that.
The whole thing is now is an opportunity for me to advance to a level which I really wanted to be at my whole life.
Sure.
As far as work. And this is interfering. The technological knowledge is there of the type of work that I do, but the ability to relate to others and not basically want to verbally bust somebody up.
Oh, yeah,
head. It's like, it's something that I'm working on. I just wanted to know if you...
Well, sure. Well, how about some ground rules? One of the things about boundaries is that nobody has a right to come into our boundary, into your individual boundary and tell you how to think, how to feel, or what to do, so long as you're not doing anything unethical or criminal. Nobody has a right to tell you what to do, what to think, and how to feel. But we also don't have the right to do that to someone else. And we always need to remember it's a great big world out there. A lot of people come to me about job problems and say, how do I make my boss behave different? Or how do I make my coworkers stop annoying me or making me look bad? And one of the most common and easy answers really is, it's a great big world out there. Get a better job.
Well, it's not so much that I
better friends. You did. Better friends. Yeah.
Yeah, I could, but it's not so much that I make people make me look bad. It's just when I know how to do something, I'm very short when I'm trying to explain it to a subordinate. I'm very short.
Set an example. You don't have to go around parading how great you are to people. Set an example. And that brings us back to your original question, which is, if I come from a family where nobody has good boundaries, how do I not, you know, shock them with my awesome new strong boundaries? And boundaries are the part of your psychology. If you've ever wanted more respect, if you've ever wanted to be strong, everybody's had like a strong but small person in their life. Like maybe your grandma was physically small, but she meant business. You know what I mean? What made her strong is her boundary, not her body size, right? So the boundary is your source of strength. When we say someone is a strong person, when we say somebody commands respect, it's not so much their body size or their weapons. It's their boundary. They mean business with their boundary. So it's solid. But you don't have to beat up other people with it, like smacking them in the head with your shield. Okay, so here's how you introduce them, like to your family or to your friends. You're going to temporarily lose some people when you start having a strong boundary. It's kind of like they've been siphoning your gas from your gas tank for years, and all of a sudden you're saying, hey, guess what? This is my gas. You can't siphon it out of my tank anymore. well, they're going to get angry at first because they're used to free gas. Mm-hmm. So be prepared for them to be a bit angry about it, but persist. And eventually they'll come around to either respecting you or you'll kind of lose them from your life for a time.
You got any books or anything that...
We're going to talk about that at the end of the show, Ed. I really appreciate those questions.
That's great.
Yeah, you nailed it. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to go to another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. My name is Al Stone, and I'm calling because I'm really concerned about a friend of mine. She's a single parent, and her 20-year-old son is, like, destroying her life. He's terrorizing her. He's physically abusing her. And she's afraid to throw him out. You know, she's afraid that she's going to get hurt because he's bipolar. And she doesn't know what to do. I heard the program. I'm like, oh, my God, these people might actually be able to give me some direction for her, you know?
Yeah.
What would you suggest she do? I mean, it's like she's getting into a really dark place in her life.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what to do with her own 20-year-old son.
Well, we all have to work on our own boundaries, and we're the only person who can make those changes. A typical problem or situation that a single mom like her might get into is you feel like you're it, you know, you're the parent, and you're wholly responsible for this other life, and so you take the world weight of the world on your shoulders. Probably one of the things she's done, so she could work on her own boundaries and realize. It's the whole community's responsibility to assure that a young man who might have some mental health issues gets the treatment he needs. It's not just her sole responsibility. So once again, a team. We need a team around this family. You know, it's what the social services programs are for. It's what the mental health system is for. She needs a team to support her. But by getting a team around her, that doesn't make her any less of a wonderful mother. It makes her a leader of a team. Okay, so that's really one of the biggest metaphors I'd give you for it, or direct advice. I mean, it's you need a team to solve this kind of problem. She's not alone.
Right, so she should seek help from social services then.
Yeah, well, and or the mental health system. I mean, a psychiatrist, a social worker, a psychologist, a whole team, a mental health team.
She couldn't get him to go into a...
She can't get him to go? Well,
she should at least begin to consult with him first.
Yeah, she needs empowered and she needs energy and resources directly for herself, supporting her. But then, you know, just like when you go to an attorney... or an accountant, you say, hey, look, I don't understand this stuff. What do I do with it? You hand it over to them. It's what you pay them for, to help you with. Well, she can hand over some of the responsibility for the mental health issues and the abuse risk and this sort of thing. She can hand it over to a mental health team and say, hey, I don't know what to do. You help me. Help me strategize this. It's a very thorough, robust system that we have these days for helping that kind of problem. She's not alone at all.
Sounds like something she could use.
Sure. Sure.
You know, because, I mean, she told me about what was going on in her life, and I was like, oh, my God. You know, no one deserves that.
Well, there's such a close, intimate bond between mother and son or mother and daughter. So, you know, she may have some possibly codependency things to work on herself or boundary issues to work on herself, so that she doesn't have to feel like she's it for this kid. It's the whole community's responsibility to help out.
I think that's what's really lacking these days, is that people just don't care about other people. They don't want to get involved. You know, and it's like, I'm trying in my best way to get involved with other people to see, you know, because I myself need help, but, you know, I figure by helping others, that helps me, you know.
Well, we all need to remember to invite others. You know, it may seem like nobody cares, but sometimes people just need a little invitation to learn about you. And that's not invading anyone's boundary, to just invite someone to communicate.
Caller, thank you very much for that. We're going to go on to another call. We really appreciate those questions.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Hi, do you hear me?
I do. Go ahead.
Great. I'm coming late to the conversation. It's very interesting. I'm reading a book that I got was in WBAI Premium, actually,
mm-hmm.
called Silent Power by Stuart Weil. Are you familiar with his work?
Sure, that was the premium that we offered on this show.
Oh, was it that? Yeah. Was it this show?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, great. It's a great book.
He's great.
And I think it really relates to what you're talking about. And in some ways, I've been practicing myself, just relaxing into my own silence. And it's been kind of effective because I noticed it kind of irks other people in power. I've noticed that. That are, you know, kind of domineering types. But I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting there doing my work, and I've been in this office with this, you know, he's head of this this region, and you know, he's not complaining about my work. I think my physical presence just bothers him.
Nothing wrong with being quiet in your space and strength.
I know. It's,
sure.
And that's what's happening. And the other people that are working under him when he leaves, they notice that, and they just, they try to say he's kind of an idiot, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But,
they try to pull you into the gossip?
well, a little bit. It just seems so obvious because, like, you know, they talk amongst themselves and I'm there. There's a very small office here. And I kind of float around because of my job. I'm, like, the only one in my company that does what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of float around and I'm in the final part of a job.
You see something right away in the story he's talking about. When somebody else is threatened by your power,
yeah,
or your silence or your lack of, say, followership kind of a thing, there might be a good part to that person who feels paternal. They feel like, you know, the father of the company. They want to be good to other people, and they want to lead, you know, their kids, so to speak. There can be a good aspect to it.
In a way, well, actually not. He's
okay.
He's known by even the people he works directly with.
Oh, okay.
Kind of I don't want to say the word over the air. He's an A.
Oh.
You know, and he calls himself a type A personality. And
okay.
And I'm a musician, songwriter, so I wrote a little tune about it. And I told him what the A stands for.
Well,
and they thought it was pretty funny.
Well, if that's the case, he may fall into this kind of second category where we were talking about John Nash and the Nash equilibrium earlier, win-win versus win-lose thinking. Mm-hmm. Someone who has win-win thinking is a constructive person and a mature person, and they have an attitude toward life that is, quote, abundant. Somebody that is a win-lose thinker also has less mature thinking, and they're a destructive thinker, and they have a scarcity viewpoint in life. So if someone's threatened by your power, they might be in the latter camp where they are a scarcity thinking person. In other words, if you're powerful, that must mean I'm not, which is not true for mature people. If you're powerful, I'll learn to be a little more like you. Maybe we can be friends, we could be colleagues, and we'll make each other powerful. That's mature. And that's better boundaries.
Yeah, I know. It's a great conversation. What's the name of the show, I guess? I should know.
This show is called In Other News.
Other news, and I guess that's where I heard. I guess you were playing the Stuart Wild CD.
They were right. We were playing the audiobook CD that we were offering.
Maybe it might have been a replay of the show.
They were. It was.
I heard it during the day one afternoon. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I heard it at night, and I said, yeah, I got to get this thing.
He's an amazing metaphysician and lecturer. He's just a great author as well. Caller, thank you so much for these lending your experience
to
the listeners in the show. We really appreciate that. That's going to do it for us. Dr. Paul, can you tell us how people can contact you and your websites and the training that you're working on?
Sure. We're doing a training this Sunday on Manhattan. If you're a man, our best work for you is at menspsychology.com. If you're a woman, our best way of working with you is at womenshappiness.com. Both of these /live-training is where you find out about our training this weekend.
And they can reach out to you through those websites?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, with my email address, it's all on there.
Oh, that's very exciting. Well, that's going to do it for us. We're going to wrap things up. We'll see you next week, 10 p.m.
People, one great big pal and big brother, and the Holy Spirit.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. It's, oh, I got it. Wait a minute. It's recorded by Irma Franklin. It's a tune called Peace of My Heart.
Sorry, Janice, but it's time for Health Action here on WBAI New York, which will be followed in 30 minutes by a rebroadcast of Monday's news, and at midnight, Mike Sargent and all of the gang with Night Shift, all coming your way tonight on WBAI New York.
You know that it ain't right. Never, 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 never hear me when I cry. You know you got it, shine if it makes you feel good.
Thank you.